This is an interview with John Olson for the SEC Historical Society's Museum and Archive of Financial Regulation. Today is May 8, 2013. I'm Robert Colby, and today's interview is taking place in the offices of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher in Washington, D.C. Mr. Olson, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Robert.
Let's jump right in. Where are you from originally?
I was born in Santa Monica, California, Christmas Eve, 1939. I'm a holiday child and grew up in California, public schools all the way. Went to University of California, Berkeley, which was then and still, I think, is a rather biased alum of more than 50 years, the greatest state university probably in the country. I do acknowledge UVA is pretty darn good, too, since you went there.
Throw our name in the ring.
The reason I went to Cal Berkeley, which was 400 miles from where I grew up, is that my father was the head of the grounds department at UCLA, basically the chief gardener there. And I'd grown up literally on that campus all the time. We lived maybe 10 miles away, and every faculty member knew me, and I wasn't going to have any privacy at all if I stayed at UCLA. And at a certain age, one wants to go off and be somewhere other than where one's parents are right at hand. And my mother had actually taught there for a while. She was a preschool teacher. Neither of my parents finished college, although they both were very, very well-educated people, but they were children of the Depression and had to go to work, and then my father was drafted, and so somehow they just never got through college. But every one of their kids did, and every one of their kids had graduate degrees, so that was typical of that generation. I was at Cal Berkeley, and fully intending to stay on and go to law school there. I always knew I wanted to either be a lawyer or a college teacher. I ended up being fortunate enough to become both a lawyer and a law school teacher, at least part of the time. And I was talking with a professor from whom I'd taken an undergraduate course in international law and done well in, and his name was Hans Riesenfeld. And I said, "Professor Riesenfeld, I would like to go to the law school," meaning Bolt Hall, now called Berkeley Law School. And he said, "I won't give you a recommendation for Bolt. You've spent your whole life in public schools in California. You should have another experience. You're a bright boy. You should go somewhere else." And I said, "Where?" He said, "Well, you should go to Harvard or Yale, and I will contact them, and I'll write a letter for you, and you can get letters from other faculty members." So I duly applied, having been – he actually did give me a recommendation for Cal in case I needed it, but – so I was accepted to Harvard and Yale, and I didn't know how to choose between them because I'd never been east of the Mississippi River. The farthest I've been is my grandparents' farm in Iowa. And so I asked around, and more people knew about Harvard than Yale, so I thought that was a good reason to go there. And I went to Harvard Law School along with two classmates who got in, and we all sort of arrived there wide-eyed and no knowledge of the east, and rather quickly formed a group called the California Club, and we had also formed a study group. It turned out there were a number of us, a few from Cal, a few from UCLA, a few from USC, and a couple from Stanford undergraduate. And we felt somewhat lonely, but it was a great experience. So that's my educational background in a nutshell.
And what did you focus on at Harvard?
I was going to be a trial lawyer. I passed up the opportunity to take a securities regulation from Louis Loss. I had him for agency on Saturday mornings at 8:30, if I remember correctly, and both Professor Loss and the class were bored to tears with studying agency at 8:30. So I said, "Well, I didn't enjoy agency, so I'm certainly not going to take his securities regulation course." And I really wanted to be a trial lawyer, so I took all the trial practice courses there were. I took the constitutional litigation seminar from Paul Freund, who was a great giant of a professor. And wrote my senior paper for Professor Freund, which had to do with admiralty jurisdiction in the Supreme Court, sort of an exotic topic, and I was going to be a litigator. And I came to, I talked to a number of firms. I worked for the summer of 1963 in New York for a firm called Donovan, Leisure, Newton, and Irvine. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was a litigation shop founded by Wild Bill Donovan, and his partners, who was the founder of the OSS, which later morphed into the CIA. He was no longer alive when I went there, but the other founding partners were all there. Mr. Leisure, Shorty Irvine, as he was called, who was Walt Disney's lawyer, And Carl Newton, who was the guy that I spent a lot of time working with, who represented all the big railroads and had been the railroad czar in World War II. So it was a group of guys that there were no gals in leadership positions in law firms in those days, the way there are now. But these guys had been very active in various ways in the Roosevelt administration or Truman administration during World War II and then founded this law firm.
That sounds like quite an experience.
It was an interesting experience, and we worked on a number of different cases during the summer, and I was offered a position there, and I thought of staying in New York, but I also interviewed with Los Angeles firms, having grown up in Southern California, and went out and visited with the three firms that were the leading firms of the time, still are, Latham & Watkins, a smallish firm then, but rising, O'Melveny & Myers, and Gibson Dunn, and I expected that I might like one of the others better, because Gibson Dunn had represented the Republican Party and had actually represented Richard Nixon at the time of the Checkers speech and had that kind of a history. So I thought I'd probably like one of the other firms better, but I didn't know. I did like the people who interviewed from Gibson Dunn immensely. Frank Wheat, who had not yet been an SEC commissioner, but was a corporate partner there, and a fellow named Dick Wolford, who was a senior litigation partner. And they were both Harvard alums that came out of the immediate post-war classes. They both served in World War II. And just terrifically engaging people. So they made a real pitch. I went out, and I had a total reversal of view as I went through the three firms. Without saying anything negative about the other two, I just found that at Gibson Dunn, there were a whole lot of really interesting, intelligent people, and they weren't all alike. First of all, they weren't all Republicans. There were quite a few Democrats. Some of them even had beards and long hair in those days, and it was okay. Some of them dressed rather flamboyantly. Some of them dressed very conservatively. They didn't look like a group of – they weren't pieced from the same pot. So I received an offer, accepted the offer, and didn't even stay for graduation at law school because I needed the money and I wanted to study for the California Bar. So I immediately arrived. As soon as school was over, I drove with one of my roommates, who was also from California, cross-country. And started at Gibson Dunn in Los Angeles, 1964, in June of 64.
And when you started there, what were you doing when you started there?
Litigation.
Okay.
That was what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And that's what I came to do, and I started working on cases, took some depositions, the first couple not very well. I remember taking one and the senior partner sitting down with me and reading the transcript and saying, John, you know, you really prepared well for this. You had great questions, and you covered all the issues. But if you read this transcript, you were doing all the talking. You didn't get the witness to say much of anything except yes, nor I don't remember. So that was a very good learning experience.
Yeah.
It wasn't a very important witness, and I got better at that. Argued some motions and won most of them. I was sort of starting in that direction when a former lawyer in the firm who had gone to join his family company as president, this is a company that owned a great deal of land in Southern California, came to see Frank Wheat and Art Schmutz, another senior partner in the corporate practice in Los Angeles. And he said he wanted to borrow a young lawyer for a couple of years for about 3 days a week to come in and help him organize a law department for this family company, because all of this land, 20,000 acres, was approaching development and they had all sorts of things to deal with, land use entitlements and all sorts of other things, which I didn't know anything about. But they came to me and said, you know, we think you have a good personality fit. You seem to be able to adapt to things. Would you be interested in doing that? And having no very good reason to say no, I said, sure. And I was a little bored with litigation because although it was fun to argue motions, in those days we had no paralegals and no computers, so document review was done by young associates. And if you had to look at a million documents, the group of associates went off to some client and looked at a million documents for 6 months. Now, that wasn't much fun. So I went over there 3 days a week. I worked with this guy whose name's still around, a good friend of mine, Press Hotchkiss. He's now in his 80s. And we dealt with every kind of problem you can imagine. I found I really enjoyed solving problems, doing transactions, and as one of my colleagues and I said, it's much more fun to work on a deal and go to a closing dinner where everybody's happy and expects things are going to go great than to work out of law school where everybody's ticked off at everybody else.
Right.
and unhappy that they're spending money and time in court and hating every minute of it. Mm-hmm. It's just a very different environment.
Sure.
Not to say that litigators aren't important. I mean, they're very important and they're great. And so I became a deal lawyer. And I did various different kinds of deals. In those days, we didn't specialize so much. So I did real estate deals, and mm-hmm. I did loan transactions, and I began to do public offerings, IPOs, and a general broad practice, starting sort of midway through my second year. Just going to my third year, sometime in 66, I got married in 66. We were opening an Orange County office, and they decided they needed to have somebody who could do deals who was an associate down there, and they asked me if I would go. Mm-hmm. And I conferred, obviously, with my wife at the time, who didn't love Los Angeles. She'd grown up in the East. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking of starting a family. We went down to Orange County, which was very rural in those days, and we really liked it. And we thought, this is a great place to create a home and start a family. So we took the offer, went down there, and I was one of the first people in our Orange County office. It actually was started in a trailer on the Irvine Ranch, which was our largest client, in 1965, and I went down in 67. I maybe was the fifth lawyer in the office and one of two associates, mm-hmm. I think. The other people in the office were doing real estate development work for the Irvine Company. One guy was doing municipal water district and sort of entitlement type stuff. And I didn't have any particular assignment, so I did sort of everything else. Mm-hmm. And over a period of time, as that community grew, and it grew very rapidly as the Irvine Ranch mm-hmm. was developed into a new town, the town of Irvine, and then Newport Beach and Garden Grove and Costa Mesa and all these others has expanded with new suburbs, and the Irvine Industrial Complex was opened to a lot of companies located down there. And I was the guy that had the opportunity to represent these companies. So I represented a restaurant chain. I helped organize a community bank, which later became publicly held. I helped set up a savings and loan. I did the first public offering for what is now Denny's Restaurants, which used to be headquartered in Santa Ana, California. It's now through lots of corporate changes somewhere in North Carolina with Hardee's, but in those days it was founded by a guy named Harold Butler, who was still around. And mm-hmm. So I did a lot of things like that, and through working for clients that were largely privately held but then were going public and raising money, I got into financings mm-hmm. and securities. So I learned my securities law on the job, and of course I had wonderful mentors, Frank Wheat chief among them. He was in Los Angeles, but he was wonderfully generous with his time and very interested in young lawyers. So I spent a lot of time consulting him, and then I worked with him on several matters, including some investigations. Stop me if you want to.
No, not at all.
So I became a partner in the Orange County office. I think I was one of the first associates to become a partner in the Orange County office, and I also, at the same time, even before I was a partner, was head of the corporate practice. By then, I had five or six younger lawyers working with me, and by the time I left and 77, I had about 12 or 15 younger lawyers working with me, and I wasn't that old myself. So it was a very young group, and we developed a very good, strong, vibrant corporate practice there. In 1976-77, about 10 years after I'd gone there, our then managing partner called me and said that we were opening an office in Washington, D.C., and we had recruited some other firms, an outstanding official in the Ford administration. I always referred to it as the Nixon Ford administration because these guys all started under Nixon, but mm-hmm. at that time it wasn't polite to refer to the Nixon administration because right. he'd resigned. But this is a guy named Jerry Parsky, who was assistant secretary of the Treasury for international and monetary affairs, a very able guy, brilliant career at Princeton, mm-hmm. and had gone on to UVA Law School. Worked very briefly at Covington and then gone into the Treasury Department as a tax guy and then Senate to Assistant Secretary. So we were asked, ultimately he agreed to join our firm. I showed him around Southern California. I was vulnerable because my then wife had grown up in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. By that time we had several children, four I guess, or mm-hmm. fourth maybe on the way, I can't remember. And so we moved here in 1977. I think the managing partner thought I was vulnerable because he thought my wife might like to get back to the East Coast, which was true.
Right.
Her family was here. And I'd done enough securities work with Frank Wheat and others that I'd actually been to the SEC mm-hmm. and I'd been to Washington and I knew something about regulation, but I certainly was not a regulatory mm-hmm. specialist. I was a deal lawyer. So here we came and we opened the office, two of us with a shared secretary, and we were very fortunate. We found a lot of things to do fairly quickly. One of the interesting things about this was that we and some other firms, so Latham was here just before us, O'Melveny came a bit before, the Pillsbury firm came a bit after, and mm-hmm. the guy had chosen to head that office up initially was my very good friend from California, Mike Halloran, who was also a deal mm-hmm. lawyer. And those of us from California and some people from Chicago, from Sidley, actually knew how to do deals, whereas the Washington firms in those days were all about regulatory mm-hmm. work and work in the D.C. courts. They knew the regulatory agencies backwards and forwards. If you wanted somebody at the FDA, you went to Covington. If you wanted somebody at the Fed, you went to Arnold Porter or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Wilmer had great strength. And so they were not firms that ever did deals because there wasn't a strong, vibrant business community here mm-hmm. then, but one was growing. So it was a wonderful opportunity for firms from the West Coast and the Midwest who had the foresight to open here. And most of us thought we were opening to do regulatory work, and we did.
Mm-hmm.
But we also had an experience, many of us, in doing transactions so that we could do them more efficiently and on a basis where the local firms at the time were not really very well equipped.
Can you talk a little bit what you mean when you say doing deals and doing transactions?
Well, I mean, for example, I handled multiple acquisitions for a company called Planning Research Corporation, mm-hmm. which was a New York Stock Exchange traded a conglomerate of professional services companies. It ultimately itself was sold to another company, which in turn was sold to Litton, which is now part of Northrop Grumman. So,
right.
They came to me because they had actually started out in California and then moved here because so much of their business was with the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of black work through various subsidiaries here for the Defense Department, CIA, and so forth. They'd moved their headquarters here. And they had tried to use one of the outstanding Washington-based firms and found it very frustrating because the people in the firm just really didn't have the experience in putting a deal together because they didn't have that much opportunity to
right.
do it. So they, because they knew some of my colleagues from California, they called and said, "Who do you know?" And they said, "Well, we've just opened an office there. Call John."
Uh-huh.
And so I did a lot of deals for them, and then I did deals for other people. Over a period of time, though, we also wanted to take over the regulatory practice mm-hmm. for our clients in California and elsewhere. And a number of serendipitous things happened. We were retained through Frank Wheat to represent a special committee of the board of directors of a company called Textron, which is a major defense mm-hmm. contractor. Their former CEO had been named Secretary of the Treasury.
Bill Miller,
yeah. And later Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Mm-hmm. And during his confirmation hearings, issues had been raised about whether or not Textron had made improper payments
mm-hmm.
in order to obtain a helicopter contract from the Iranian Air Force, then under the government of the Shah. And through Frank, we were retained to work with a special committee of the board of Textron to conduct a multinational investigation. And Frank
wow.
was in California. He came back and sort of got things rolling and was available and came to some of the key meetings.
Mm-hmm.
But he asked me to basically manage it, and we recruited people from all over the firm. Through that, we got to know a great many lawyers in Washington because there were a number of people, including Bill Miller, who had their own individual counsel, as mm-hmm. happens in an investigation. And through that and some other matters that came through our California office that I was assisting Frank and others
mm-hmm.
on, I got to know people like Stan Sporkin and Harvey Pitt and others because I was going to the SEC. So I
mm-hmm.
found myself basically moving from being a deal lawyer to being an investigative lawyer, which called on my old interest in litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Interviewing witnesses and
right.
assembling evidence and writing reports and so forth. And my number two, or maybe number three after Frank Wieb on that matter, was a senior associate in our firm named Ken Starr, who later had some fame for other kinds of investigations. So I always figured the first investigation he ever did was under me. Maybe I trained him well, maybe not, depending on your point of view. He's a wonderful guy. I'm still in touch with him, now president of Baylor University.
And you all worked together on Textron?
We worked together on Textron. And then as a result of that, the chairman of that special committee was a prominent Washington lawyer from Baker. Hostetler named Webb Cook Hayes. Is that right? Was it Baker and Hostetler? No. Anyway, Webb is not now with us anymore, but he was the grandson of President Rutherford B. Hayes, and a great guy. But we finished that work and made a report, and there was a settlement with the SEC and the Justice Department. And as counsel for the special committee, we were involved. Arnold and Porter was counsel for the company, and others were involved. But Williams and Connolly was involved, representing some of the individuals and so forth. We got to know a great many people. But through Webb, he was also chairman of the audit committee of the National Bank of Washington, which was the oldest bank in Washington. And they had some issues, the bank regulators, and some questions about how they had made loan underwriting decisions because their stock was majority owned by the United Mine Workers through an investment made many years ago by John L. Lewis back in the time when the bank had been troubled. And the allegations were that they had made loans to friends of the mine workers which were not properly underwritten and resulting in possible losses to the bank. And there were... So I was brought in there because Webb knew me from Textron. And I was brought into another bank. I won't bore you with all. But we got to the point where we were doing a couple of investigations a year. But I was still doing deals.
And these are investigations into the internal workings of companies.
Right. These were internal investigations either under the aegis of a special committee or an audit committee. And we would then produce a report, typically. And this whole technique was pioneered by Stan Sporkin in 76, 77. The problems coming out of Watergate.
It's all part of the voluntary disclosure.
Part of the voluntary disclosure program, although after a period of time became less voluntary after the FCPA was enacted. Right. And these bank runs were not FCPA issues. They were not foreign payments issues. They were questions of improper activities within banks. And I had one involving an agricultural bank up in Pennsylvania where the guy was in cahoots with some farmers and taking kickbacks and making loans that were no good. I had one involving a bank that was being merged with another one, and they were doing diligence. I did large number, a couple a year. Now we have people who are real pros doing it, all former prosecutors, but Ken and I were learning our way.
I'd be curious to hear a little bit about what it was like doing these investigations.
That's fun because it's a little bit like what you do as a historian. I mean, you're trying to reconstruct what happened, whether laws were violated or not, who was responsible. You are conducting a lot of interviews. You're looking at a lot of historic documents, some recent history usually, but over the last several years, typically they cover a period of several years. Each one is different, and over the years I've done many. And it's a very interesting exercise because it brings together a lot of different skill sets, analytic skills, both in terms of law and factual analysis, the kind of skills a litigator has in conducting interviews, getting information from witnesses. You don't have subpoena power. You have to be persuasive. Dealing with other lawyers, because people that are subjects of these inquiries often have lawyers. So it's, as I said, done a good many. So far, I'm still not involved in corporate governance, except that these committees are part of the corporate governance apparatus.
Right.
I mean, they're key committees, and the ultimate report goes to the board, and you meet with the board, and you brief the board, and you, as counsel to the committee, which becomes sort of special counsel to the board, you make recommendations. So I was spending a lot of time in boardrooms with a number of different kinds of companies. I did one for a title insurance company here that had some corruption issues here in D.C. I represented a special committee of the board of the big department store, Woodard and Lothrop, in looking at competing bids to take over the company. So a wide variety of things. And like doing a public offering in securities work, you have to learn about the company, which is a lot of fun. This is what I'd enjoyed with that old job in Los Angeles working for the big family landholding company. I mean, you've got a huge variety of problems, and you're learning about a new business every time you do one of these.
Right. And so this is at the same time as the, as you said, the FCPA reforms are coming, the reforms that the stock exchange puts out. Did you see those having an effect in the companies that you were working on?
Yes, and during that as that time period went on, I had joined the Committee on Federal Regulation of Securities at the suggestion of Frank Wheaton. Mm-hmm. And in those days, you had to, each firm would only have two members. So we had three, I think, George Bermont, Arch Schmutz, and Frank Wheaton. Mm-hmm. Arch Schmutz was very busy with other things. Graciously gave up his seat so I could go on. Mm-hmm. Years later, I became, in the 80s, became chairman of the, mm-hmm. the committee. And my predecessor, Jim Cheek, and I did away with that and, mm-hmm. and opened the membership up to much broader people. Actually, Dick Phillips was Jim's predecessor mm-hmm. and started that process. So I got involved in that, and I think Dick Phillips, he was the chairman or was mm-hmm. rising to leadership. He asked me to head up a task force examining the law of insider trading and making recommendations mm-hmm. as to whether there should be a federal statute more clearly defining mm-hmm. insider trading and sort of just see what the bar should do mm-hmm. because there were a lot of insider trading cases, but there was a feeling among the bar and among academia that the law was developing in ways that were sort of very much case-dependent, case-by-case.
Right.
There is no federal law of insider trading except Section 16.
Right. This is in the wake of Dirks and Chiarella.
This is actually...
or is it before?
Right around the time of okay. Dirks and Chiarella. Exactly right. So we put out a two-volume report, and I was doing that while I was doing all these other mm-hmm. things. So I was getting deeper and deeper into securities law and finding it very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Because of that work, I was asked to chair a subcommittee of the Committee on Federal Regulation of mm-hmm. Securities, which I did for a number of years, and ultimately I was asked to become vice chairman, and so I sort of was going up through the ropes there. And as a result of that and the work I'd done, been doing with Frank Wheat and others, I was getting more and more matters before the mm-hmm. SEC. For example, when the Boone-Pickens attempt of a takeover of Unocal mm-hmm. occurred, we were representing Unocal on the defense side. My partner, my now retired partner, Andy Bogan in Los Angeles, was leading that. But here in Washington, we and Wilmer were co-counsel for Unocal. So Ted Levine, who was then mm-hmm. at Wilmer, and I were dealing with the SEC on a daily basis and ultimately prepared a well submission to persuade them not to sue Unocal when mm-hmm. Unocal did an exclusionary tender offer. They did a tender offer which was available to everybody except Boone Pickens and his allies. And he screamed bloody murder, and the SEC wanted to do something about it. Mm-hmm. They proposed a rule that would have prohibited exclusionary right. tender offers, but they never adopted it. Mm-hmm. And we ultimately persuaded them, and particularly persuaded Gary Lynch, who was then the head of enforcement, that they were going to lose the lawsuit if they brought it, because although they talked about the rule, they never adopted it. They mm-hmm. subsequently did. So I was dealing with the commission right. in connection with our transactional and uh-huh. defense work. I grew up in a firm. When I came to Gibson, there were 90 lawyers. Now mm-hmm. we're 1,100. I think Wilmer was probably 70 lawyers in those days. I mean, we were smaller firms. Mm-hmm. People tended to do a lot of different things. We didn't specialize as right. much. So it's kind of hard to go back and recapture those times. They were wonderful times. We worked hours and hours and hours. I mean, it was mm-hmm. very common to work 2,300 hours, chargeable hours a year and 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. But it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And over time, I think people came to think that I knew something about the securities laws and that I was, within the firm at least, I was thought of mm-hmm. as an expert and kind of the go-to guy for dealing with the SEC.
You sort of take over from Frank Wheat in that respect?
No, yeah, Frank was by that time getting closer to retirement, mm-hmm. and he wanted to stay in California, and he was very interested in a lot of public interest things. He mm-hmm. was really primarily responsible for creating the California Desert National Preserve mm-hmm. And doing lots of other really good works, the Sierra Club and so forth. So he was moving into those areas. And I think in those days we had pretty much mandatory retirement at 65. He had a very active career mm-hmm. after that mm-hmm. In public service of various kinds. So, yes, I was. I think I got his mantle, at least anybody did, at least for the securities part of the practice.
And this would have been, I mean, the early 80s you think of as the liveliest time for tender offers and deals.
They were, and we had our share of those. And I would be involved, along with the team I built here, and I've got to give great credit to them because I've brought in a lot of good people. We were involved in the Washington end of those, so we dealt with the Office of Tender Offers, as it used to be called, now the Office of M&A.
Okay.
And we dealt with the Enforcement Division, and we dealt with Corp Fin on a regular basis on all the different deals from all around Gibson Dunn.
So your role was to sort of smooth things with the SEC as these were or make sure you're in compliance?
It's more than that. We would do compliance checks, but it was really to help the people that might be handling a deal in New York, because we had a New York office by the mid-'80s, and in California. Understand what the SEC's concerns were going to be, plan the deal in a way that was not going to run into problems, and then lead meetings at the SEC if there were problems to work through them. Over a period of time, I came to know many, many people at the SEC quite well. And of course, when you live in this town, you meet people and you see them socially, and you have kids in the same school and so forth. I remember Elise Walter and I had kids at Concord Hill, which is a little private elementary school out in Bethesda at the same time for a number of years, and so I used to see Elise and her husband at meetings and things like that. So it was and still is to some extent a fairly small town. People that are in government and in the law know each other pretty well, which is one of the appealing things about Washington. So it's more than just doing a compliance check. People who don't live and work here regularly don't really understand always the imperatives under which government employees work. And the people at the SEC are outstanding people for the most part, and it's a very fine agency. But they have statutes that govern what they do. They have a Congress that watches their budget. They have procedures that have to be followed. They have to be conscious of the fact that they're working in a fishbowl because of all of the various transparency statutes, Sunshine Act, which covers commission meetings, all the statutes that require the production of documents. FOIA, well, those statutes didn't exist 30, 40 years ago, but they certainly do now.
Sure.
They basically mean these folks are operating under constant scrutiny in a way that people in the private sector are not, which causes them to sometimes seem cautious. But they also have a responsibility for consistency, for even-handedness, and for understanding that whatever they're doing is going to be second-guessed. And when you spend time dealing with folks in that situation, you don't fully understand how challenging that can be.
So you're almost serving as a liaison between your own people and the folks at the
SEC. Yes, yeah. Now, as this community's business segment has grown and there have been more sort of mind shops here, we've also developed a significant transactional practice. I don't personally do that anymore, but we have several partners and a team of people who do. For example, one of the clients that I've been the relationship partner for going on 20 years now is Marriott International. We do almost all of their transactional work. I don't do it personally, but I do meet with their general counsel regularly and have lunch and talk about how we're doing and see to it that it's properly staffed. Sure. That's a management function. We do their securities and compliance work as well. We do that for quite a few companies in this area. We have very good long-time client relationships and all over the country. So we feel that we have an obligation with all those clients. We have about 80 companies that we regularly counsel on securities disclosure and governance issues, all told, among our various offices, close to 100 now. We put out regular client bulletins. We try to keep track of what their particular concerns are to see that they're kept informed. We want to be the place they come when they have an issue, and I think we've succeeded in doing that. And I spend a fair amount of time on that, and I enjoy it. I like working with clients. So how did I get into governance? Is that what you're going to ask?
It depends on – I was going to ask about a little bit more about the – you started talking about insider trading, and I was curious. One of the things – that I'm curious about is how did you get involved with rewriting or trying to rewrite?
It's all because of Dick Phillips. It's because I did that study. I don't remember the years anymore. I have to go back and check my records. But you probably don't. Chiarella and Dirks came down, and there was a case involving Foster Winans.
That's 87. Carpenter's 87.
Well, when the Carpenter case was pending, in the lower courts before it got even to the Second Circuit, where the government was, it was actually a criminal case. It wasn't an SEC case, but the SEC was very concerned that they would end up with a precedent that limited the reach of the emerging doctrine of insider trading, particularly the misappropriation doctrine. So they had a strong interest in that case. And that case was in the lower courts, and there were some other cases around the same time. Senator Riegel, who was a senator from Michigan, who wrote a book, he was a member of the House before, they wrote a book called Oh Congress, which was all about sort of his diaries and experience in Congress, which was quite, because it talked about a lot of interesting things, including people's affairs and so on. He and Senator D'Amato, who was the ranking minority member on the Senate Banking Committee, decided, with advice from their staff, and their senior staffer at that time was actually Steve Harris, who is now a member of the PCAOB. Right. Mm-hmm. So Steve was on the Hill for a long time. That's where I first met him. That they ought to try to put in place a bipartisan bill sort of defining the scope and extent of insider trading liability. Mm-hmm. Particularly dealing with how far the misappropriation theory and tippers and tippies were going to be carried and so forth. Because there was a lot of concern in the business community, but also the SEC side. When the SEC was nervous about the Supreme Court taking, and again, the chairman at that time was Dave Reuter, who I had known from ABA work by then, they put a committee together consisted of Harvey Pitt, Ted Levine and me, and then we had other people working with us. And I think for some reason we were the co-chairs. I think because I'd written that study, and Harvey and Ted had been prominent at the SEC, Harvey as general counsel, and Ted's a senior member of enforcement. We were all in different firms. Right. So we wrote a statute with a lot of help from various people, and it was introduced in the Senate by the two senators, Democrat and Republican, and they scheduled hearings, and we testified about it. But then, sort of in the midst of the legislative process, and before it got too far, the Supreme Court split on Carpenter. And the result is the Second Circuit affirming the expansive view of the misappropriation theory was affirmed. And the senior people at the SEC, career people, said to Dave Reuter, and I think Dave agreed, we don't want to have a statute now because we're doing fine in the courts. So they withdrew their support, and the sort of pressure for it from those who were supporting a strong SEC enforcement program in the Congress, including Senator Riegel, kind of evaporated. I think Senator D'Amato would love to have gone ahead with it because the Republicans would like to have sort of compassed, you know, put some of a ring fence around the concept of insider trading. That we just did at lunch yesterday of our monthly luncheon group of senior securities lawyers, we talked about whether there was any end to where the concept of insider trading was going to go. We're now talking about people that know, that do this research into what the government's likely to do and then sell the information. The government's going to do this with respect to health plans, I've heard. And is that insider trading, or is that simply good research?
Well, and the market break helped kind of put a break on the momentum on that also, didn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting exercise, and again, I think helped identify me in the name, in the minds of clients and others, as somebody who knew something about the SEC.
So from there, how did you get into the governance issues?
Well, I was actually doing a deal. I was selling a bank and an insurance company to a bigger financial services conglomerate, and I was negotiating, and this would have been about 25 years ago, I was negotiating across the table from a senior partner at King & Spalding named John Hopkins, who went on to become general counsel of an insurance company, not the one we were dealing with then. And we got to be quite good friends, even though we were going toe-to-toe over the table. We actually would have a drink later, and we finally got along very well, sort of saw things more or less the same way. And we both had done a fair amount of board work as a result of our deal work and investigations and other things. In other sense, we'd had occasion to advise boards of directors on various questions in connection with deals or these investigations that I'd done and so forth, and we found that the dynamic in the boardroom was interesting, and we sort of swapped stories about what that was like. About maybe a year or so after that deal, he called me up and said, Bay Manning, Bayless Manning, is retiring from Paul Weiss. He has been serving as independent counsel to Coca-Cola's audit committee since 1976 or 77, when they had had a big questionable payments problem. Mm-hmm. It was actually pre-FCPA. It was a problem in South Africa, as I remember. And they're looking for somebody new who can give them a good, you know, 15 or 20 years. And I think you'd get along with those people, and you'd be good because you understand what things are like in boardrooms, and you've done deals, and you're not one of these pointy-headed people who spent all of his time in government or only thinks like a prosecutor. Uh-huh. So I've recommended they talk to you, and they're going to talk to several people. So I said, well, gee, I don't have thought about doing that, but I have worked with audit committees. I've done investigations. I'd be happy to talk to them. And, you know, Coca-Cola is Coca-Cola,
right.
So I'm certainly not going to say no. So lo and behold, I'm visited by the then deputy general counsel of Coca-Cola, who came up, later became the general counsel, and we had a very good meeting, and he said, thanks very much, I'll get back to you. And then a bit later, I had a call that the chairman of the audit committee, who was a former cabinet secretary, was going to be in town, and would I have meet with him, so I had lunch with him. And then I got a call about a week later and said, you're it, if you want to take it. But you can't do anything, your firm can't do anything else for Coca-Cola.
Okay.
And I said, well, we do some work for Pepsi. They said, well, you got to have a, you know, you got to have a ethical screen. You can't talk to the, you know, you can't be, no information is supposed to pass.
Right.
But at least, I've been ever since that time, still am, independent counsel of the Coca-Cola Audit Committee. And so I would go to the meetings, and I would try to keep them briefed on events, and I would be consulted about issues that would come up. And the word kind of got around that I did this because there were a number of people that were on the audit committee. Warren Buffett, for one, was on for many years, a number of other prominent people. So people would say, well, who knows about corporate governance or who knows about audit committees? My name would come up. So I backed into it, and it was never a huge representation, but it's always been a very interesting one. It's a great company, very, very interesting. So that's how I got into corporate governance. I didn't really think of myself. I got there really two ways. One, by doing investigations for a number of different kinds of companies and having to make reports. I remember I did one for, within a period of about a year, I did one for a big railroad company, I did one for a bank, and I did one for the department store that was selling itself here. So, and I found the work really interesting. So I started writing a bit about it. I was, along with Harvey Pitt and some others, I was one of the original contributing editors at Legal Times when it was first founded. And I wrote fairly regularly for them, short pieces. And so something I'd started writing about audit committees, I started writing about some governance issues. And then Amy Goodman, my now partner, who was then, had just left the SEC where she'd worked on corporate governance issues with Harold Williams, and was editing publications for what was then Glasser Legal Works, now, what is it now, Walters Kluwer, had asked me to serve on the editorial board for the Corporate Governance Advisor when she set that up. So I wrote some articles for her. So I got interested in the area and I started writing about it. Then I wrote a book with a co-author on director and officer liability and indemnification and insurance. So, yeah, we're talking about directors and officers and role corporate governance and liability and what do you do about insurance. I got into that because after the Smith against Van Gorkum decision in 1984, I guess it was, 85, in Delaware, there were a number of companies that had problems getting insurance. Insurance rates went up. There were concerns.
Insurance for?
Director and officer liability.
Okay.
Because that was a decision where the Delaware Supreme Court held the directors personally liable for a failure to take adequate care in connection with the sale of the company.
Okay.
And basically, the company was sold to Jay Pritzker for, in the court's view, too cheap a price with too slight a process, and mostly too slight a process to justify the sale. Done, negotiated very quickly with the CEO of the company personally involved, not much reliance on outside advisors and so forth. So it was sort of was a real wake-up call for American corporations, and it impacted the availability of insurance against that kind of liability, sent the rates up, made it less available, got people worried. At the end of the day, I think Pritzker paid the damages that were assessed against the directors. Interested enough, it's like maybe he thought he did get a good deal.
Yeah.
And So I was working with corporate clients and addressing those issues, so I started writing about that. Well, that's corporate governance related. And in that same time period, I was chairing the Committee on Federal Regulation of Securities. It's a mouthful. We used to say FedReg. I was chairing FedReg. And we were having programs dealing with those issues.
Were they particularly prominent at the time, or is it what people were interested in?
I think they were prominent at the time because all of a sudden directors were worried about liability and people were worried about process. Suddenly the process by which decisions were made became very important, not just in that case but a number of others, because courts have a hard time, that's why we have a business judgment rule, deciding whether the result was right. It's not really the court's job to decide whether it was a good deal or a bad deal, but they have an easy time, because lawyers are trained to do that, deciding whether or not the process was thorough. So the cases in Delaware tended to focus on process. And even in the case of federal securities class actions, particularly if we're talking about decisions by a board made in connection with disclosures related to a company that's offering securities to the public, either because of Section 11 liability or the 33 Act, where you have a defense if you exercise good due diligence after exercising good diligence, have reason to believe that there's any deficiency in disclosures. In the case of a 34 Act, Section 10B, there's a question of scienter. Were you reckless? Well, both to establish that you're not reckless and to establish that you've exercised diligence, so for two of the key liability statutes, process is all important. So companies became, as class actions were mounting and as the risk of liability was perceived as being greater as a result of Smith against Van Gorkum and a few other cases, there was a lot of focus on process. And process is, governance is process. So what does the board need to do? What advice does it need to have? What kind of meetings does it need to hold? What information should it have in front of it? All those are governance issues, and I've found myself, as did many other lawyers, advising companies about those things. And because I had this history of being in the boardroom for other purposes, I think people thought I had some credibility, and I was comfortable, and directors were comfortable. A lot of them knew me from other situations. And there were a number of us that really moved heavily into that area in that time period. Marty Lipton was already there because he was the chief sort of defender of corporate America. Ira Milstein came in as an antitrust lawyer originally for GM, but then began advising directors. And others became involved. But this really began in earnest in the early 80s and intensified in the mid-80s.
And as you're talking about process, is that something that at that point was sort of not well-defined and you're defining it? Or was it
well? I think the courts were defining it as they went, but we were trying to anticipate what the courts would require and also take the court decisions, particularly the court decisions in Delaware, but also looking at what federal district courts and federal appellate courts were saying constitutes recklessness. What do you do to avoid being reckless? And then, of course, later on, we had all kinds of add-ons through Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank, particularly the certification requirements of Sarbanes-Oxley and the requirements for independent audit committee and the requirements for the audit committee to independently relate to the auditors and to hire and fire the auditors. All of that came in, but that was later. And that, of course, I will say, though, after Sarbanes-Oxley, I used to go to meetings at the Coca-Cola Audit Committee and others as needed. Once that was in place, and particularly the procedures under 404 to verify the adequacy of internal controls and to get the auditor's opinion on that, and the concerns about what you do when you retain the auditors and what the audit committee has to do in terms of reviewing quarterly filings and so forth, all that sort of came to a head. And I started being asked to go to all the audit committee meetings for a number of companies, at least for a period of several years. And I started going regularly to board meetings. So the practice really exploded. In part because of federal legislation. We had the federalization of some of the standards of corporate governance. First, with respect to audit committees, we moved over to Dodd-Frank in connection with compensation committees. And again, this drumbeat of potential liability, both on the state law front and on the federal front, and class actions where you have to establish that you weren't reckless or that you exercised due diligence.
Now, when you're in this is... in the early 90s is when you get involved with the FedReg committee, or is that earlier?
You know, I can't remember my dates.
Okay.
You'll have to look at my bio.
Yeah, I think it's in the early... So, something... At that point, were you also working the advisory committees of the stock exchange?
Yes, I think I was either chair or active, at least, in FedReg when I was asked to join the advisory board of the what was then the NASD. Mm-hmm. And I served on that for a term of, 6 years or whatever mm-hmm. the term was, I can't remember. And then simultaneously and rather uniquely, I was also asked to serve on the legal advisory committee of the New York Stock Exchange because mm-hmm. they were fierce rivals at right. that time, and the thought was you couldn't do both.
Right.
But either wise or reckless people decided that a couple of us could. And I think I was on both, and I think maybe the late Al Summer was on mm-hmm. both. It was unusual, but I wasn't unique.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stayed on the New York Stock Exchange Legal Advisory Committee for three-year terms, and after each term you had to take a year off. Mm-hmm. So I was on for 9 years, but it was actually over a period of 11 years,
okay.
almost more than a decade. And chaired the task force on listing standards mm-hmm. and various other things. It was a very interesting time. It was when the New York Stock Exchange was really riding high. Had a very, very strong chairman who later got issues raised about his compensation. But I thought that he was a great chairman. Now, I wouldn't, being on and I've done work with some exchanges since that time.
Uh-huh.
In recent years, I've done some governance work with two different exchanges. Uh-huh. But it's a lot tougher to be a stock exchange than it was then. Basically, there were two major markets. They were fierce competitors. The Amex was kind of disappearing mm-hmm. and eventually was absorbed by New York.
Mm-hmm.
But... now it's a much tougher environment with so many different markets and dark right. pools and so on. But it was an interesting time to be involved in that. I think it was, I would say, Robert, that the nice thing about this career and what I've liked about securities law once I really got into it is that it is a profession that is practiced by people that have an intellectual interest in mm-hmm. the law and that care about mm-hmm. the development of law. They tend to be very bright people. And it's somewhat, you know, it's somewhat complex. It's got its own universe, kind of like mm-hmm. the tax code.
Right.
You have to spend some time before you really understand it. Mm-hmm. And but once you're admitted to the brotherhood and sisterhood of the securities
right.
bar, it's a very good place to be. And I think that's still true. I think of myself as a corporate governance lawyer, but I think of myself first as a securities lawyer.
Uh-huh. So
the funny thing is I never took the course. And the first time I systematically really examined was when I taught the basic course at Cornell as a visiting professor in 2003. And then I had to actually, you know, pick out a case book and
right.
read everything and prepare all
right.
the lectures. I learned a heck of a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure going back over
it. Write an exam. And
right. You kind of have to decide. So in teaching, you kind of have to decide what your students need to know, right?
Yes. It's a real art, and I think I've gotten somewhat better at it. I've been doing it for mm-hmm. quite a while now, but it's very different from CLE instruction to practicing lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
I like that too, and you have to learn that you really have to have objectives in each class of getting across a few things.
Mm-hmm.
You really can't get across 25 things, and you're dying to because you've got 25 things to
right.
say.
Right.
So you've got to edit your own lesson plan, at least in your mind, and say, okay, here are the things I think that this class really needs to accomplish. And you need to get, what the takeaway is going to be. And each class you want to, build so mm-hmm. that you're, at the end of a semester, have created a system of knowledge that's going to be useful to the students going forward. I remember when I was teaching that securities regulation class at Cornell in the spring of 2003, we got to about the second or third class, we were talking about materiality, and I realized that most of these students had never had a course in accounting, or at least many of them had not. So I
mm-hmm.
said, how many people have had an accounting course? And less than half the class, maybe less than a third. So I said, we'll stop here.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about some of these. I said, next time I'm going to have a special class. And I said, I'm not an accountant, but I'm going to teach you what you need to know about accounting, because we can't continue talking about materiality if you don't understand, if you had an opportunity to learn about the basic concepts of accounting. That was a real good lesson for me. Now law schools are putting accounting classes back in and making them available. If you want to be a business lawyer and you don't understand the basics of accounting, you're kind of at loss. So anyway, you learn to be humble. You also learn that you may think you're saying a lot of great stuff, but only about 20% of it is getting through, which is why teachers repeat,
right?
And why they have outlines, and why they come back.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's good practice. It's also good because those same skills you have to use in a boardroom. If you're talking to a group of lay directors,
right,
you really can't go off into a bunch of legal technicalities. You need to tell them what your recommendation is or what your conclusion is, why it is, give them opportunity to ask questions, and then go back over to be sure they're comfortable with it. And so it's not unlike teaching a class, but it's a different kind of class.
Right.
And it's also you're not actually there as they're, with students, you owed a certain amount of respect and they call you professor and so forth. Directors don't owe you anything. They're mostly, this is a lawyer. What does he know about our business?
Right.
So you got to earn your credibility.
So if I could jump back a little bit, I'm looking through the issues in the 90s that we haven't just, I'm building, want to work towards sort of the,
we're going to run out of time.
Is there anything else from the early and mid 90s?
Well, I noticed in the outline you sent me that you do talk about one share, one vote at the New York Stock Exchange.
I didn't know if you were on the advisory committee at that point or if that was something you were involved
in. I was, but actually I was involved in a different way.
Okay.
I was retained to represent a group of companies that had dual class voting systems.
Okay.
The New York Times, Dow Jones, published the Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
The Los Angeles Times Company and A.H. Velo Corporation that publishes the Dallas Morning News.
Mm-hmm.
I was retained by them to represent their interests in connection with the SEC's attempt to adopt a one-share, one-vote rule, which was struck down in Business Roundtable against SEC here in the D.C. Circuit. And then following that, we didn't file anything in the case, but that was done by Business Roundtable. And I think actually I wasn't retained until right after the case was decided.
Mm-hmm.
But then Arthur Levitt was the incoming chair of the SEC, and he was using a lot of moral suasion, basically issuing a diktat that the exchanges were going to adopt a rule. And so I represented them in meeting with the exchanges and with the SEC senior staff in trying to be sure that the rule grandfathered them, allowed them to continue to issue high voting shares when they thought it appropriate in connection with options to employees and in connection with acquisitions and so on. And we successfully negotiated that so you could maintain your system, and also you could go public with differential voting, as many of the high-tech companies are doing. But once you were public, you couldn't sort of change the rules of the game.
I see.
That was the compromise that eventually was adopted by the exchange. So I was very much involved in that on behalf of those companies, was, I suppose, something of a conflict with my position on the New York Station Legal Advisory Committee. But the Legal Advisory Committee didn't make any decisions. The Legal Advisory Committee was designed to be a cross-section of people of different points of view, practitioners, academics, people representing investor groups. It was a very – and you didn't – Dick did not want anybody to tell him how to run the exchange, let alone a bunch of lawyers.
Sure.
It was purely advisory body. We got briefed on things. We gave advice. We did give some advice on some technical parts of listing standards having to do with approval of equity-based compensation plans for officers. I actually headed that task force.
Sure.
And we were consulted a little bit about this, but it was really negotiated at a very high level.
Okay.
And the SEC staff there, under Arthur Levitt's direction, had the final say on what was in the rule for the exchanges. They were very, very heavily involved, including Linda Quinn, who was then head of Corp Fin, and various other people. I'm trying to remember. Rick Ketchum was head of market regulation then, but whoever the heads of those divisions were, they were very heavily involved, as was the SEC's general counsel and members of the commission.
So I'd like to jump ahead to some of the auditor independence. How did you see that from looking from a governance perspective?
Well, I think with respect to auditor independence, that Sarbanes-Oxley and some predecessor rules that have been adopted under Arthur Levitt, after a lot of negotiation with the AICPA, has generally been pretty successful. Mm-hmm. I think that the old overweighting of consulting, which could be viewed, and I think sometimes was, as interfering with the independence of the auditors, has been largely corrected. There's a lot of awareness of that, and audit committees are certainly aware of that, and the various proxy advisory agencies look very carefully at the balance between audit and non-audit services, and they make recommendations. So I think that that's a success story. I have been involved. I've advised a lot of audit committees. Our firm, I wasn't heavily involved, a little bit, represented the AICPA in the negotiations that led up to the final provisions of Sarbanes-Oxley with respect to the PCAOB and auditor independence, and with respect to the rules prior to that that had been adopted by the SEC under Arthur Levitt when David Becker was general counsel the first time. But I was peripherally involved in that, gave some technical advice, but it was other partners here who did most of that.
I'd be curious how the boards you were advising at that point viewed the reforms.
Well, boards are always concerned about reforms because they're not sure they're going to work. They think they're going to be burdensome. They may require additional process. They may create risks of liability. So I think there was trepidation about this, and the audit firms had the same trepidation, if not more so. It was affecting their business model. So there was a fair amount of angst. I think after Sarbanes-Oxley, the principal irritant was the cost and elaborate process required for the 404 assessment of the adequacy of internal controls. And there's a view among many in the business community that was a bit of a conspiracy of regulators who really wanted to regulate a lot and audit firms who saw it as a business opportunity to do a lot more work. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but that was the view at the time, and people were unhappy. And ultimately, under Chairman Cox, with AS5, the standard, which the original AS2 standard, was altered in ways that made it less burdensome to do the 404 assessment, allowing a risk-based top-down approach when appropriate and so on. Now, to some extent, the PCAOB is pushing back and saying the firms may have carried that too far, but that turned out to be the major irritant. The business community fairly quickly, after initial concerns about audited, about it, accepted CEO and CFO certification of the quarterly and annual reports. I think people embraced and audit committees felt empowered and continue to feel empowered by being given direct responsibility for hiring the auditors and overseeing the auditors and hearing from them privately. The AS16 requirements on communication between auditors and audit committees, I think, have generally been pretty well received. So there are some issues out there that are concerned. The mandatory rotation of auditors is a real concern. It hasn't happened. Whether it'll happen or not, hard to say. But I think that structure has worked pretty well, and I think that statute, in that respect, has been something of a success. And indeed, compared to Dodd-Frank, it's almost a model of judicial economy. At the time, we thought it was kind of a dog's dinner, a mess of different things, because Sarbanes-Oxley was thrown together in a great hurry after Enron and WorldCom. Basically, the president announced he wanted to sign a bill by the end of the summer, and the Congress took that as an opportunity to put everything that was in the hopper into the bill. So it's a somewhat messy bill, but not nearly as messy as Dodd-Frank.
Well, let's talk. In talking about Dodd-Frank, one of the things
I will tell you one thing.
Sure.
I have a strong, very strong philosophical view about auditors and audit committees. They are engaged in a symbiotic relationship. The independence of both and the good faith of both is critically important to that, to corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important that they be candid with each other. And I think the structure of having the audit committee in charge of the auditors isn't a very good one. But too often, and I think it's changing for the better, auditors were either viewed as by some company managements and sometimes by directors, but even more often by managements, as sort of a necessary evil, kind of like lawyers. You had to have them around at certain times.
Right.
You don't want to feed them too much or give them too much information because they're going to aggrandize their role and get in the way of a real business. I think that's got to change, and I think the audit committee has a real responsibility for being there to see that the auditors are listened to and that they have the resources that they need. I think it's not an adversary relationship at all.
Mm-hmm.
It is a relationship where the auditors are being retained along with the audit committee to try to provide an appropriate independent check on the financial statements. They're not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a guarantee.
Right.
It's an audit.
Right.
And people need to understand that. And I think I've enjoyed over the years very good relationships with all of the audit firms, even though we disagreed on things.
Mm-hmm.
And I worry because I'll have clients who will come to me and say, boy, these auditors are terrible. They're making unreasonable demands. They're taking a position that doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
My view is, you know, you got to understand where they're coming from. There's almost always a reason. Sometimes you can persuade them that they're headed in the wrong direction. But I feel pretty strongly about that. I feel the same way about investors being in corporate governance.
Okay.
I've come over the years to be much more understanding of the drivers behind institutional investors. And it's not just short-term performance, although they're criticized for that, and sometimes rightly so. But I think the good institutional investors, and there are many of them, are really concerned about the long-term health of corporate America. I've been very happy to be involved for the last decade or so in the work of the Aspen Institute Corporate Value Strategy Group, which has put out two statements of principle, bringing together all those different disparate forces to try to focus on long-term issues as opposed to making short-term decisions, and also trying to focus on bringing people together in a cooperative relationship as opposed to adversarial relationship. And I read the papers every morning, and we're always interested to see one board or another that seems to be in a battle with institutional investors.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes maybe that's justified, but my overall view is it's not productive, and that both sides or all sides ought to be able to find a way to come together because they have common objectives, which is the health of the enterprise.
Right. Well, I mean, you've sort of been in this industry since institutional investors really started wielding their
influence. I have.
And then how have you seen that change?
Well, I think there's been a maturing on both sides, or at all sides. I think well-advised companies understand the imperatives that institutional investors operate under. And they are performance-driven because they're measured by performance, and they're, in some cases, compensated by performance, which is probably better than compensating them on the basis of assets under management.
Mm-hmm.
And companies are driven by various goals, including performance over various periods of time. And one of the problems is, you say, that you know, the shareholders are the owners of the company,
mm-hmm.
and the board ought to represent them, and that the company ought to be run for the benefit of the shareholders. Well, that's there's some truth in that.
Mm-hmm.
But in practice, we mean the person who's only a shareholder for 20 minutes or who's in and out of the stock four times in the same day? No.
Right.
Do we mean somebody who's in there as a pensioner investing in his own or her own company's stock?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. And do we mean, we used to talk about the widows and orphans whose trust funds are in there? Do we mean the big pension plans? We mean all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
To say it's for the benefit of the shareholders is only the beginning. The way I get comfortable is saying, well, if you're worrying about the health of the enterprise and the reputation and long-term value of the enterprise, you're probably on the right track because you can't really figure out what the goals are of every individual group of shareholders.
Right.
And if you did, you'd drive yourself nuts because they'd all be cross-purposes.
Mm-hmm.
What about a short seller? Do you have an obligation to the short seller?
Sure.
Make the stock to do a terrible job so that they can cover
right.
Cheap.
Right.
No, you really don't. So it's but it's fun to think about those things. And when you're advising a board, I mean, they know they got a fiduciary duty, and they know that the duty is to the entity and ultimately to the various. Now we tend to talk about stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
Some countries like UK now, it's explicit as a duty to stakeholders and not just shareholders. But then, you're making decisions. What does that mean? What does that mean? Do you have to take the premium offer right now because it's on the table and it's higher than the current market price? Well, the answer of the courts has been no, as long as you're not conducting an auction. If you're conducting an auction, you got to get the best value mm-hmm. you can get, or mm-hmm. at least make an effort to do that. If you're trying to manage a business for a goal of having a bigger business in 5 years, and you've got a master plan for doing that, and you've got the building blocks, and is it reasonable to say, well, let's wait and see what happens with the 5 years? Probably. Mm-hmm. Courts say that's okay, as long as you're doing it honestly and not trying to game the system in some mm-hmm. way. And so it's fun to be advising in right. situations like that, because there isn't any easy answer.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of times, I was at a symposium in Seattle, at Seattle University, a couple weeks ago, and a couple of guys, Chris Pereira from GE, who's head of their sort of corporate governance and securities now, and a hedge fund manager who's a friend of his, put on a series of sort of problems, mock problems mm-hmm. for a board of directors, making choices between different alternatives, where you don't know the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, here are the actual possible outcomes. Mm-hmm. It was simplified to make
yeah.
it. But there's a room full of corporate directors and advisors. We were really struggling, you know, actually voting on how many of us would make the one that mm-hmm. take the choice which was sure to was reasonably sure to double your return in 5 years and bring a risk of loss, or do we take the alternative where you can get 400% on your money in 5 years, but the risk of loss was also 400%. Mm-hmm. Which one do you take?
Right.
How do you make the decision? Which is right? Well, neither is right. It depends on your risk tolerance. Right. It depends on what the nature of the decision is. It depends on your assessment of likelihood of success. It depends mm-hmm. on what you think about whether the management can actually carry this out.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very interesting, complex, multi-part decisions.
Right.
And it's really fun to be yes. around when that happens.
And there's just so many factors.
Yeah, and how much can lawyers do? Well, lawyers can basically say a few things. They can say, if you got a personal interest or some family member, business associate does in this transaction, you got to be very careful. Full mm-hmm. disclosure, maybe recuse yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Don't participate. That's fairly easy. For the rest of it, you got to be careful. You got to take the time to understand what the choices are. You got to get the right information. You got to think together with your fellow directors. You got to deliberate, and then you make a decision, mm-hmm. and you'll probably be okay,
mm-hmm.
even if it turns out that you made the wrong choice.
Right.
You made the 400% chance choice, and you have the big loss. Generally, people don't get in trouble for business decisions if they're sincerely made without conflicts of interest,
mm-hmm.
as long as they're careful about it.
Right. And like you were talking about earlier, made through the right process.
Yeah, so which is where... And lawyers do know process. We're good about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's essentially what corporate governance is. It's right. process. It's right. process for making decisions that are going to be both more likely to be sound decisions because the process is good, and also mm-hmm. going to be defensible if they're later turn out to be problems.
Right. So if we take a few minutes to talk about some of the Dodd-Frank issues.
Yeah.
One of the things that sort of is the latest iteration is the shareholder access issue. I'd be interested to hear, as you've followed corporate governance, how have you seen that debate sort of?
I always thought it was kind of a sideshow.
Okay.
My friend Ann Yerger and I talk about this fairly often. She heads the uh-huh. House of Institutional Investors, and she comes to my class every year, and she said, but it's not going to be a factor for most companies very often for a couple of reasons. One is people are not going to vote for dissident nominees unless they're unhappy with the current board.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to have dissident nominees through proxy access, you first got to put in place a system that gives you proxy access, which requires support of a majority of the shareholders voting and then action typically by mm-hmm. the board, because most of the proposals are precatory, they're not mandatory. I think there have been a few attempts to put in place a bylaw through the proposal process. Hard to do, given the word limits and given the fact it's hard for people to understand the details. So I think it's going to happen in a limited number of companies. Now, the interesting thing is this few weeks ago, the shareholders of Verizon, by a majority vote, adopted a precatory resolution saying they wanted proxy access. Now, Verizon is not a troubled company, as far as I know, and I'm not quite sure what motivated that, but that's kind of interesting, because that would prove that maybe Ann and I are wrong in our view, that it's not going to be used all that often. But I think the general thought is it'll be used when companies are really troubled. In the few cases where it's been adopted, that's been so. I think the SEC, by being stubborn about a mandatory proxy access rule, going way back to when Harvey Goldschmidt and Bill Donaldson started the ball rolling and they weren't able to carry through, and then it was looked at during the Cox time, and a lot of back and forth, which we don't have time to talk about, but the net result was a proposal that was put out early in the tenure of Mary Shapiro, and then Congress came along in Dodd-Frank and said, yeah, you got the power to do it, so that took away the argument about whether the SEC had the authority. And the question was, should they do it and how should they do it? The business community, by and large, and the American Bar Fed Reg Committee, not under my leadership, but under new leadership, said you really ought to try private ordering first. In other words, let people have the ability to put in place a system through the shareholder proposal process, and then if that happens, see how it works. And only if you think you're not getting where you need to get, should you have a mandate, because mandates are one size fits all, and they don't always work.
Right.
And the SEC didn't listen to that, and they went ahead with a rule after the statute came and went ahead very, very quickly. Made a mistake, I think, in trying to cover investment companies, which got the mutual fund industry upset with them. And investment companies already have a lot of governance protections and are a totally different kind of structure. So they ended up with an embarrassing and really brutal opinion in the D.C. Circuit. Many of the SEC's alums, maybe glad the SEC, are hurt by the sort of the tone of that opinion, and I understand that. I think, personally, that the commission would have been well advised to follow the advice of the Fed Reg Committee and others and try private ordering first. The result is we have private ordering now, because the business community didn't challenge the changes in Rule 14a8 that would make it possible to have private ordering. So we are now, we're in our second proxy season of seeing how many companies are going to see those proposals, whether they're going to be approved by shareholders or not, and how they're going to work. I think it's early days. I'd be very surprised if the SEC comes back with a mandatory rule, because I don't think they want to get burned twice. And I don't expect to have a ton of companies go to proxy access by private ordering, because even if you get two nominees on the ballot, if you really want to get them elected, you've got to spend some money to campaign. Just getting them in the proxy statement is helpful, but unless the companies, the shareholders, are really upset, why would they pick two people that they don't know? So they have to be outstanding people, and it has to be a company where it's appealing to have them there. Now, I'm not quite sure what the end game is at Verizon. I'm interested to see what happens. If the board responds by putting in place a system, and perhaps they put it to shareholders next year and it's approved, then in the following year, will we see people actually making nominations or not? And we'll see that maybe a few other companies. So I think it's an experiment that will go on for a while, but I don't think it's the major action. I think, interestingly enough, the other thing that that Dodd-Frank did that's turning out to be more important is say on pay. And again, it's not a majority of companies. A majority of companies are getting approval, but a significant minority are getting negative recommendations from one or more of the proxy advisory firms, and in those cases, they're getting something in a significant, not a major fraction, but a significant fraction of those cases, they're getting negative votes or very high, close to negative votes. And I think that is impacting the way compensation decisions are made. One can argue whether it's a good or a bad way. It hasn't really lowered total compensation much, but it's probably changed the way it's put together.
How so?
Well, I think we're seeing people making an effort to demonstrate to the satisfaction, at least the proxy advisory firms, that it's performance-based.
Okay.
That when the sort of return to investors from the company goes down, the compensation goes down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, recent example, it's very much in the press, of course, is the reductions made in Jamie Dimon's compensation at J.P. Morgan mm-hmm. Chase. Although, interestingly enough, it wasn't because the earnings went down. It's just because of the problem with the London Whale mm-hmm. thing that the board took action. Would they have done that in a non-say-on-pay environment? Very possibly. Hard to know. But people are very focused now on whether or not executives' compensation responds to problems with performance or perceived mm-hmm. problems in mm-hmm. management.
There are other things that came coming out of Dodd-Frank that you see as affecting corporate governments, or are those two the?
I think they're pretty minor. I mean, there are a number of changes with respect to compensation committee consultants and independents and so forth. But there are things that were already underway mm-hmm. with the SEC. I don't think they're major changes, and I don't think they'll change behavior a lot.
Okay.
People are moving to independent consultants anyway. I think say on pay is the biggest thing.
Okay.
And that's something that the institutional investor community has wanted for a long mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that the statute was carefully crafted to permit companies to select between annual, biannual, or triennial votes, and almost everybody ended up going for annual, and all the investor groups wanted to go to annual, except for the carpenters who wanted to do triennial. But
that's interesting. Yeah, why do you think they did that?
The carpenters?
No, just the general move towards annual.
I think it became the view, certainly it was the view of the institutional investor activist community, which is not all the institutional investors, mm-hmm. and the sort of Bebchucks of the world, that holding directors' feet to the fire on an annual basis in any way that you can is a good thing. I think, and I think that concept can be carried too far, because what it does is promote short-term thinking and short-term action. But in the compensation area, I don't think it's terribly harmful.
Mm-hmm.
There was a concern, which I shared. I mean, I voted, not that you pay attention to how I voted to my few shares of each company. I voted for triennial because I think most good compensation plans have a longer time horizon than 1 year, and mm-hmm. I'm much more interested in what the company's compensation is as compared to performance over a 3 or 5 year period than I am in 1 year.
Sure.
Intellectually, I'd rather see a more meaningful, less frequent vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understand the idea of making directors accountable on an annual basis. That's why the academic activists, as I call them, the theoretical activists, are working so hard for declassified boards. I mean, they want to have excitement every year. They don't want to have There are some problems with declassified boards. One is it makes it hard to evaluate directors.
Declassified board meaning?
Every director is up for re-election every
okay.
year.
Right.
It's a little bit like a problem we have with the House of Representatives. If you're running for re-election all the time, it's very hard to get you to think long term.
Right.
And in corporations, if every director is running every year, and the directors are supposed to evaluate each other's performance, how do you do that?
Right.
With a classified board, but only a third are up each year, it's quite easy to do because the governance committee usually is made up with members of each class, and the people that are up that year don't participate in the evaluation. It's done by the governance committee mm-hmm. remaining members who are not up this year, and in consultation with other directors. So mm-hmm. it's easier.
Sure.
But that's not the fashion of the hour. I think Marty Lipton and I and a few others think it's too bad
mm-hmm.
the staggered board or classified board is going away
mm-hmm.
Because we think it actually provides some stability and continuity, and it makes it easier to manage board departures on a 3-year cycle than if you have to worry about who's going to be on the slate every single year.
Right.
And and if you have a director who's new on board, you already know. It takes a while to get to know the company,
mm-hmm.
and it takes the other directors a while to evaluate how effective they are. If you're doing it on a 3-year horizon, it just works better.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that battle's been lost,
hmm.
at least for large companies. Although you see many companies going public with staggered boards, and they'll keep them until the activists get after them and make them give them up.
Gotcha. I know we're running a little short on time. Is there anything else you'd like
to... Yeah, I've got a 4 o'clock call.
Anything else you'd like to cover?
I don't think I've indulged. You've indulged me greatly.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. I appreciate you taking the time to do it.
No, it's been fun. I'm looking back, I mean, I've been practicing almost 50 years. I could be talking for another 4 hours and really bore you to tears.
All right.